and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme, Seascapes. We hear about a remarkable commemoration on Whiddy Island next weekend to remember a US airman on the site of the old US naval seaplane base on the island. Norman Freeman, author of Sea Spray and Whiskey, has a tale about prunes, the Prohibition Police, and Bombay. First on Seascapes to a vessel which was lost off Lambay Island in the Irish Sea in January of 1854. Of the 650 aboard, only 290 survived. Listeners to Seascapes will be familiar with the story from the book written by Edward Burke, Bound for Australia, The Loss of the Emigrant Ship Taylor at Lambay on the coast of Ireland. While a new book by Jill Hoffs, The Sinking of the RMS Taylor, The Lost Story of the Victorian Titanic, was recently published by Pen and Sword. We spoke a few weeks ago with the author Jill Hoffs from a BBC studio in Manchester.
I live in Warrington. My accent is Scottish, but I actually live in the northwest of England now. And I was in for a mooch and they had a display of a porthole and some old crockery with limpets on and things like that. And one of the curators saw me looking and had a chat with me and said, oh, there was this massive ship, the Victorian Titanic. It was built here, inland. You really need to read the survivor accounts. And I did, and they just got right under my skin. They really haunted me, for want of a better word. And I was gripped. The bit of the Mersey where I live, when it's the summer, like now, you can pretty much walk across it. So to have this almost 2,000 ton ship built here was mind-blowing to me, and a lot of people don't know about it. It was quite a short-lived industry here. Warrington is far better known for things like Vimto and wire and bricks. And they actually wondered at one point about putting the ship onto some giant wooden wheels to get it past a shallow part of the Mersey, which sounds almost comical now. But yeah, this was a tremendous undertaking. She was built in the summer of 1853, and it was a rushed bodge job, and she was launched a few months later, January 1854, and sadly sank 2 days into her maiden voyage. Now, one of the many parallels with the Titanic is that this was an enormously hyped ship. The papers were full of puff pieces, exalting its virtues. And if you were going to risk going overseas, this is the ship you wanted to be on. It was a very, very dangerous business travelling overseas in those days. The newspapers were full of accounts of shipwrecks, ships going missing, just never turning up at their destinations. At least 3 or 4 shipwrecks in British and Irish waters recorded a day. So if you were going to do it, this was the ship to be on. And she was a beautiful ship. It's just very unfortunate that she was so badly fitted out.
Now, one of the remarkable things that comes out in your book is the fact that there were no sea trials, there were difficulties with the compass, and this was all for a brand new vessel, which was, as you say, a rush job to start with.
She was originally meant to sail in November, and bearing in mind that she'd only launched from Warrington in October, this was quite something, a month to fit out this massive ship and sort rigging and what have you. She was put back, and eventually the owner said, no, she has to go, and they went. Now, the captain, who was a remarkable young man, he had quite large concerns about the compasses. They didn't really understand the interaction between compasses and magnetism and iron hulls at the time, although there had been a suspected result in that the Birkenhead, the HM Birkenhead, the origin of Women and Children First, had this same fault. Now, it was fairly standard at the time for there not to be sea trials. Liverpool was a very, very busy port. It was massive. There just wasn't room, especially for a ship that dwarfed the rest of the ships that were moored there. It would be expected that if it was a new ship, you're not really going to have problems. A lot of the ships that were sailing to Australia and America at the time would have holes in the sides. They would be, really quite rickety. So you could kind of put your faith in this new ship that she wasn't likely to sink. And because she was iron, she wasn't that likely to catch fire either. He was headhunted for the job. He was a very able, brave, and kindly captain. He had a great reputation. The ships that he'd previously captained had done the journeys overseas in record time, say 13 months for a three-stop voyage. With minimal deaths, he'd handled the ship in storms so well that his logbooks were actually used as a teaching aid for other mariners who were looking to become captains. He was the guy that you wanted on your ship to make sure it got there and got there in a speedy time. He was an orphan from Penrith in Cumbria, and he kind of pulled himself up by his bootstraps. He worked his way up from a very young age to become captain. He was only about 27 when he was captaining the Taylor, which seems quite young now. I know that people tend to have a mental image of sea captains as being kind of grisly and gruff and a bit like Quint from Jaws, but he was nothing like that. He was a very able, healthy young man, and what happened with the Taylor completely destroyed him. Have a real mixture of people, different abilities, people that had worked together before, people who hadn't, and that would have sorted itself out the further out they got to sea. I mean, a couple of the people were so drunk that they actually tied themselves into the sails away up the masts and hid from the captain when they were doing the kind of hard work of leaving port, and he was not pleased about it. Again, this is just part and parcel of the time. However, added into a dodgy ship and other factors, it all kind of piled together to lead to a disaster.
There was difficulty controlling the vessel and the actual movement, wasn't there? But there's a great story about Samuel Cardy. You might tell us about him, because not alone had he already travelled to Australia where this vessel was bound for, but he'd come back having turned his life around, really.
Oh, he was a wonderful man. He was a former convict. He'd gone out when he was about 22 with his mate and slaughtered a sheep. He'd got very, very drunk to celebrate his upcoming wedding, and they thought, oh, we'll get some mutton to help celebrate. They botched that and were caught, and the newspapers of the time didn't really have the same libel laws as you do now. So they've got quite gossipy accounts of what happened, which is wonderful for a researcher like myself. And yeah, he was sent abroad. He was sent for 10 years to Tasmania. He was lucky that he hadn't done it a couple of years prior, because otherwise he'd have been put to death. And it was, you know, for a lot of people, this was the equivalent of a death sentence. But he actually flourished. He turned his life around. He got an early pardon. The gold rush happened just as he was coming to the end of his sentence. And he made an absolute fortune. And he sailed straight back to his girlfriend, the one that he'd been meant to marry all those years before. And his son, who'd now kind of grown up and was 13, took her by surprise, married her, and very forward for the time, he settled a fortune on her. It wasn't just that he married her. He actually gave her money in her own right. So she was a wealthy woman in her own right, and persuaded them to come back to Australia, not to dig for gold, although, you know, I dare say if they'd found some in the soil, they wouldn't have turned it down, but with a big cargo of shoes, because a lot of the people that were going out with the Taylor weren't going to dig gold, they were going with cargo. They were going to make their fortune by selling things to the other immigrants there, because whatever you needed, you had to take out.
And of course, we're forgetting at the time that there were a huge number of Irish in Liverpool. We're talking just after the famine period. big difficulty for anybody in either England, Scotland or Wales in terms of finding work. So emigration was the order of the day.
It absolutely was. And a lot of the people involved in it were quite unscrupulous. They saw it as a way of reducing the pressure here. So they would bombard the poor and, as they saw, feckless, and promise them gold. They'd actually give women gold chains at village meetings and say, no, you know, you can have this if you sign up to go, if you sign up to leave the village and leave the country. And they sent off young children, female children in particular, as breed mares, basically, because they were too young to have been engaged in prostitution, which was rife at the time. You know, people would do whatever they could to survive, and for some of them that meant, well, going overseas.
I wonder if they flew one day, no one ever knew they'd gone, to circle over ships at sea.
Now, Captain Noble found a great ally in a doctor. You might tell us about him.
Oh, he was one of the people that touched me the most on board. Dr. Robert Hannay Cunningham was from Fife, and he was about 27, and he was a very educated young man. He got his medical results when he was actually in Peru, which I thought was quite extraordinary, because I never really thought of people as travelling that much back then, unless they really had to. He'd already been to Australia, set up his medical practice there, did really well, and came back for his wife and his two young sons. And they were sailing out with their servant and all sorts of, you know, like bits and bobs for in Australia, medicines and what have you. And when the ship went down, he was one of the heroes that totally stood out. I mean, Dickens spoke about him. That would be Charles Dickens. And this man, he gave his life for so many people, and I think it's shameful that he's been forgotten now.
But also people have forgotten about the fact that, say, for instance, that the White Star Line was involved, that the masts were in the wrong location on the ship, and that there were the big connection, I suppose, or parallel with the Titanic years later, was there were insufficient lifeboats aboard.
Again, this was fairly standard for the time. People actually fought against lifeboats. They saw them as dangerous, as a risk, something to get in the way, to trip over, to give people a false sense of security. So there was massive campaigns in the newspapers of the time saying, you know, please don't make us carry anymore. The lifeboats wouldn't have done the people in the Taylor that much good unless they'd been deployed well in advance. But they only had quite a short window of time between sighting the island and crashing into it. It was foul weather, and it was actually the middle of the day. It's just that because the weather was so bad, visibility was really poor. They only saw it maybe half an hour before they ran into it, and it was described as rising like a mountain from the sea, with rocks black as death. And I sailed out to it with Yacht Doris last week. It was incredible, and it was so sad. And I couldn't imagine 20 people on those rocks, let alone 290. I just can't imagine what they went through.
And of course, there was such confusion, and you describe that so eloquently in the book, about the fact that so many attempts were made to rescue people. Trying to get a line, as you say, onto those rocks was a near impossibility.
It was, and yet people kept trying. People risked their lives again and again to try and get the people off the ship, and some of them managed it. And that was incredible to read about, to read of people being pulled out by their hair, or babies being carried off between people's teeth. But also there were all the horrible deaths where people clung onto ropes and then were pushed by the people from behind. The death toll was horrific. I mean, more than half of the people on board died, and they died, you know, very violent deaths. And it was literally within jumping distance of land. And the wreck was actually sighted. I mean, people in on the mainland of Ireland actually saw this happening. But when they reported it, because another ship had gone down, I think it was the night before, it was dismissed because it was like, no, we've dealt with that wreck, which just shows you just how common wrecks were back then. There's a wonderful site called the British Newspaper Archive, and I joined that, and I just typed in Taylor, and thousands of articles came up, and some of them were from before she actually set off, which was good because you could really see, well, the hope that people had for this ship, and also some of the kind of complaints, somebody saying, oh, you know, the porthole in my cabin leaked and it's a bit damp and things like that. And it, you know, it was fairly typical. But then to have the first reports coming in and the confusion and then all the kind of first person accounts, and some of them were just devastating, you know, especially the people that like saw their brothers being washed away or whole families, you know, coming off the rocks. It's heartbreaking. For the time, they were luxurious. I mean, they made a big deal out of the fact that they had two flush toilets for about 700 people. Two. Sounds really grim to me now, but at the time, that was great. Because it wasn't standard necessarily to have proper flushing toilets. There were accounts from maybe 10 years before that of women actually holding it in because they couldn't go to the bathroom until they died on some of the longer voyages. So, you know, this was a big deal. They had staircases between the levels instead of just ladders, props under hatches. It was meant to have loads of air, be really fresh and you know, hard to catch diseases when you're, you know, cooped up under the decks. It was supposed to be this marvellous ship, and I think it would have been if they hadn't bodged her up. I think the biggest surprise to me was finding that there was so much about this ship, such a big deal had been made of it at the time, and then there's virtually nothing about it now. I mean, you'll find a lot more on the kind of Dublin coast than you will anywhere around Liverpool or Warrington. There's no memorial here at all. There's no mention in the, you know, White Star Line exhibits and such like. It's effectively been erased from history. And I also managed to get in touch with the granddaughter of the convict's son, and that was amazing. She had no idea. And to actually be able to say, no, your family are heroes. Your family did this, they did that. Here's what they looked like. That was incredible.
What changed after the Taylor? And there's obviously a legacy that was left by the loss of the vessel.
Woefully little. I mean, they did change some legislation. It almost comes across as a kind of token attempt to pacify people. They made it that ships had to be towed for further than they were at the time of the Taylor, until they were like right out of that area and wouldn't bump into Lamb Bay again. But really not much. The generosity of the Irish at the time of the wrecking is mirrored by the generosity of the Irish now. I mean, truly, whatever I asked for, people were bending over themselves to help me with. It was great, and thank you to them.
The Sinking of the RMS Taylor by Jill Hoffs is published by Pen and Sword and is available from a selection of bookshops. The music we heard was from the late Sandy Denny and North Sea Grassman and the Ravens. On Sunday week, the 28th of June, on Whiddy Island, there's a special US Naval Seaplane Base commemoration. The local community will unveil a hand-carved stone memorial on Whiddy Island to commemorate the young Marine, Walford August Anderson, from Monette in Missouri, who tragically died in a seaplane crash on the 22nd of October in 1918 while returning to the base at Whiddy Island. The itinerary for the commemoration includes a large flotilla of boats, including the Bantry Inshore Lifeboat and Castletown Bear RNLI, which will leave Bantry Pier at 12 noon and visit the crash site. There, Kim Kemp, granddaughter of the pilot of A1072, will partake in a wreath-laying ceremony at sea, following which they will return to the new pontoon area off Whiddy, where the memorial is located, for the unveiling ceremony. The unveiling of the memorial will be performed by Lieutenant Colonel Sean Costin of the US Air Force and Defence Attaché to the American Embassy. Musical accompaniment will be provided by a string quartet who are in Bantry as part of the Bantry Chamber Music Festival. There'll be a poetry reading by Nell O'Regan, poet and director of the West Cork Literary Festival. The Irish Navy will be represented, the Irish Air Corps, and representatives of the American Legion will also attend. Following the unveiling ceremony, there'll be a break for refreshments, and presentations will be given by noted Irish aviation historian Tony Kearns and historian Ted O'Sullivan, as well as Colonel Barry Hannon of the Irish Air Corps and Lieutenant Colonel Sean Costin of the US Air Force. Sean T. Rickard of the American Legion, who will be present on the day, will give a brief account of Irish-American aviation links, such as the flying boats in Foynes and the early Irish Air Corps pilots who made transatlantic flights. Next to broadcaster and writer Norman Freeman, who has this tale from the Southern Ocean and a visit to Bombay.
As our passenger ship tied up alongside Alexandra Pier in Bombay and the gangways went clattering down, the team of Prohibition policemen came forward in their smart dark purple uniforms. The job of these zealous fellows was to see to it that no alcohol of any kind was taken onto the soil of the state of Bombay. The strict ban on the sale and consumption of alcohol was being rigorously enforced. As soon as they came on board, they sealed the bar. Our ship, of course, was well stocked with a wide range of spirits and beers. The captain and officers were European, mostly British. Many drank heavily. It was a consolation for having to endure the heat and humidity. Alcohol didn't cure heat rash or dobe itch or homesickness, but it made them easier to put up with. Prohibition was a sore trial for many. Among those who tried hardest to get the better of it were the Irish radio officers on Eastern Service, attached to the Bombay office of the Marconi Company. We served on ships of the Mogul Line and the British India Company in the 1950s. My boss, the chief radio officer, took some risks. Our cabins were routinely searched after we docked. The police sometimes pulled out the drawers and shone torches along the dark spaces behind. However, they were in awe of the radio room. It had an air of importance about it, with its impressive array of transmitters, receivers, automatic alarm and other equipment. Their search was no more than a respectful casting of eyes around before departing. Thankfully, they were unaware that behind the polished grey metal covers of the transmitters, bottles of gin, whiskey, vodka and brandy had been laid along the tops of the valves. One of the most memorable episodes of outwitting Prohibition arose when a dinner party was planned in one of the big hotels in the city. The challenge was to have alcohol of some kind to enliven the evening. But it would be too risky to try to carry bottles down the gangway. The police were always around. Then one of the great characters of the Indian coast, Billy Bradshaw, a fine and decent man from Tipperary town, came up with a clever solution. He ordered a large bag of stone prunes in one of the markets and had it hauled on board. His ship was sailing to the Red Sea, to the port of Jeddah. The prunes were laid out on several trays and taken up to the very top deck of the ship. There they lay under the baking sun, day after day. They shrank until they looked like small, wizened black fragments. The next stage was to put them into large jars. Then gin was poured in on top of them. By the time the ship arrived back in Bombay, the prunes had absorbed the gin and regained their original size and look. On the night of the dinner, the gin prunes were taken ashore in a transparent sack. The Prohibition police merely glanced at them, assumed they were a consignment of ordinary prunes. We all assembled at a table for 20, guests, friends, girlfriends. We asked for 4 or 5 plates and for toothpicks. When these were laid out on the table, the prunes were unloaded. They lay there, soggy with gin, their black skins glistening under the table lights. Soon, arms stretched out to spear gin prunes with toothpicks, mouths opened wide to take them in. By the end of the night, our table was in uproar. When we eventually started to leave, one of our male guests lost his footing and tumbled down some steps. An Indian friend of ours shook his head and said, "No party is complete unless some fellow is falling down the stairs. Just the same, it's better than getting run over by a speeding taxi."
Norman Freeman, author of Sea Spray and Whiskey and that tale of the Prohibition Police. The current under-21 men's laser radial world champion, Finn Lynch, has been shortlisted for the prestigious Nissan Generation Next competition, which recognises up-and-coming sports stars. The top six nominees will win a Nissan for a year, which would be of considerable assistance to Finn during his campaign for the Rio 2016 Olympics. Finn would like to call on the Irish sailing community to vote for him. All you need to do is click on the link on the Irish Sailing Association website, www.sailing.ie. Seascapes will be in Derry next week. Mary McBreen will be there for us, and we'll bring you much of the flavour of the excitement on and off the water as the yachts arrive into the city for what promises to be a terrific maritime festival. So that's Seascapes next Friday night, featuring the Clipper Ventures Round the World Yacht Race and the Derry Maritime Festival. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.
In 1803 we sailed out to sea, out from the sweet town of Derry. For Australia bound, if we didn't all drown, and the marks of our fetters we carried. In the rusty iron chains we sighed for our wains, as our good wives we left in sorrow. As the mainsails unfurled, our curses we hurled on the English and thoughts of tomorrow. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry.